From across the country to around the world, you're listening to Terra Informa. I'm Hamdi Issawi.
And I'm Natalie Raweth, and we'll be your hosts for the next half hour of environmental news. On this week's show, we have our eye on the Wild Rose province, Alberta, though not for its advantage.
Imagine stumbling into a pitch-black mineshaft with no canary, no idea where you're going, or even where you are. Well, in a sense, this has been the experience of some northern Alberta communities for a few months now. Only they haven't stumbled anywhere. It's the mine that's come to them.
On October 31st of last year, well over 600 million litres of wastewater poured out of the tailing ponds at the Obed Mountain Coal Mine and into the Athabasca River, making it the largest spill of its kind in Canadian history. Now, more than 4 months later, inquiring Albertans are still in the dark as truth surrounding the spill has proven to be about as clear as the muck itself.
What effects will this disaster have on waterways, wildlife, and the well-being of neighboring communities? More on that story to follow, but first, conservationists are running afoul of developers and calling for emergency action to protect a bird with plenty to grouse about.
When a species of bird or prairie landscape go into decline, there's often a whole slew of reasons behind it, which makes it challenging to motivate all the different interest groups who could play a part in the recovery.
Industry, government, farmers, researchers, and activists all face the same question. What's in it for me? The difficulties in answering that question have pushed Alberta's greater sage-grouse to the very edge of survival. Terra Informa's Chris Chengyan-Phillips and Danielle Dolgoy bring you this story.
Now, if you listen carefully, there's sort of a pop, and then right at the end of the pop, there's a little shh. Those individuals that have the little shh at the end are strongly preferred by females.
This is Mark Boyce. He's a biology professor at the University of Alberta. He's been researching the greater sage-grouse since the late 1970s. That noise you just heard? That is the sweet sound of a male greater sage-grouse as he struts and whistles for the attention of the females looking on.
Ooh, boy. The greater sage-grouse mate at this isolated spot on the prairie called a lek. The females, as is their right, are very selective when it comes to choosing a mate. After weeks of rehearsing, it's showtime. The females arrive at the lek and observe the males while they perform this spectacular display. The female grouse position themselves around the lek and will watch the males hoot and holler as they strut around for several days before taking one of them home. If any one of the males plays hooky even once, he's out of the running. If he shows any sign of illness, he can forget about it. No, I don't want no
scrub. The scrub is a guy that can't get no love from me. The females are shockingly astute at figuring out how healthy these males are, and Mark Boyce conducted the most epic cock-blocking experiment to determine exactly what the females are looking for.
Language, Chris!
What? They're literally called cocks, and hens in the case of the females.
Lice concentrate on the air sacs of the males, and they chew on the air sacs and create little hematomas. And I can see the hematomas, and surely the females are able to pick up on that as well. So we did experimental work and used a red magic marker and created little hematomas on the air sacs.
You drew on the birds?
Yeah. With a little red magic marker. We had an experimental setup where we had these artificial leks with males in cages surrounding a central arena. We put a female in the arena and then looked to see which males she went to sit by. And there was very strong selection for males that didn't have lice or that we hadn't painted the red splotches on.
I think it's hard to go anywhere on this planet and see something as spectacular as that.
Meet Cliff Wallace.
My name is Cliff Wallace. I'm vice president of the Alberta Wilderness Association. I also co-chair the Sage-Grouse Partnership in southeastern Alberta, where we're working with ranchers, industry, and government to try and get sage grouse back on that landscape.
Cliff has waged a fight to protect the greater sage grouse for the better part of the last 40 years. Things were going well for the protection of this species until certain industrial interests began advancing on the land to explore potential oil, gas, and mineral extraction.
So there was a lot of oil and gas activity moving into that area. And despite the advice of the biologists and Alberta Fish and Wildlife at the time, that oil and gas development went ahead.
The birds are very sensitive to disturbance, and the numbers have just been going down and down. So we went from a couple thousand birds maybe 30 years ago to the latest count is 14 males in Alberta. And they're typically a similar number of females, maybe even a few more females.
And so, you know, there was very few options left to us. We had the Species at Risk Act federally, finally, and we decided we'd take the federal government to court and say, this is a big problem. We don't have a recovery plan. We don't have protection for this species.
Well, I wrote a deposition and
really?
Supporting it.
And through a series of court cases working with EcoJustice out of Vancouver, we've been able to secure critical habitat in Canada on paper. I must emphasize that because very little has changed on the ground.
Just like the female sage grouse who takes her time before making her decision and acting on it, the federal government sat on the sidelines for a long time before taking action.
We've also got this emergency protection order.
The emergency order then came into effect just a few days ago. And so this is to provide more assertive protection for the birds and for the birds' habitat and to try to reduce disturbance of the birds.
There are many interests at stake here, not just biologists or oil and gas lobbyists.
When my grandfather first came in 1900, this country hadn't been grazed for a number of years, and there wasn't that many sage hens. But by the time my father was in his teens, sometime in the 1920s, there was a lot of them.
David Heidloff is a third-generation cattle rancher in Many Berries in southeastern Alberta.
I'm also a member of Ducks Unlimited, as well as being involved with the Fish and Game Club.
David has a unique perspective on the greater sage grouse. He's very fond of the birds, just not necessarily of all the attention they bring to his land.
Well, everybody keeps telling me we're so lucky because we've got several endangered species, but basically it's a big pain in the neck because we've got the bird watchers and the biologists and everybody else. Sometimes they can be an annoyance, but I do like seeing them around. They've been around for a lot of years. When they're dancing, they're fascinating, and you can hear them if you got a large bunch of them. Like at one time, a few years ago, we had over 100 roosters on the lek on our property, and you could hear them for over a mile.
David's main concern now is on protecting the ranch that his family has built. The federally leased land that the Heidloff family ranch sits on will face new restrictions on the number of animals permitted to graze.
Like this environmental protection order, we don't know how much it's going to affect us yet. And if we can only put half as many cows out there, well, that kind of reduces your potential for income for the year to 50%. There's other things that's in there. For instance, any new fences, you've got to get special permission to put up a new fence. Yeah, it can take anywhere from probably a couple of weeks minimum to 6 months.
It's not as though David is some great opponent of this species. In fact, he and Cliff have been working together to find ways to protect them.
Yeah, he and Cliff Wallace have actually been working together as the co-chairs of the Sage Grouse Partnership, which is a group representing environmentalists and the oil and gas industry and local people like David, who are all trying to work together to find ways to protect the sage grouse.
We kind of thought they should be protected, and on top of that, we kind of wanted to know what the AWA was doing. Yeah, it is a big-time commitment, and the meetings are 50 miles from us, so it's a monetary commitment, too.
Wow.
Because I got to drive 100 miles every time I go to a meeting. Usually, it's on our own nickel for getting to and from, and it's on our own nickel for our time, for sure. A lot of the people that are saying what we should or shouldn't be doing, I'm wondering if they'd have the same kind of a viewpoint on them if it was actually costing them money. basically, I think we got to try and protect them because the percentage of the population in the rural area is a very small portion of the percentage of the population of the people in the city. And basically, it's the people in the cities that are hollering the loudest right now. Then, you know, we've got to survive. If we can't keep the guys in the city a little bit happy, they're going to run right over us.
And David makes a powerful argument. Many people's livelihoods are tied to natural resource extraction and land use. We asked Cliff why he believes the federal government is now whistling a different tune.
I think there's an embarrassment and shame thing going on here, quite frankly, that they know they have to do this. The courts, you know, were on the precipice of ruling to make sure that this happened. So they have to be proactive. And I mean, it was really on the day of the court case, just as we were heading into court, that the decision came down on the emergency order. So, you know, obviously it's that 11th hour decision making, and it's not because they're really committed to it, it's because they're dragged into it. And I think that's a pretty sad state of affairs.
So, all of that to say, where does this leave the greater sage-grouse? All puffed up and nowhere to bone, it would seem.
Oh, Danielle, don't despair. This protection is only beginning to be rolled out. The battle continues as municipalities like Medicine Hat, eager to benefit from oil and gas revenue, fight the protection order. So if you would like to someday see the great mating dance of the greater sage-grouse, here are some things you can do.
Write letters to your MLA or your MPs. I know a lot of people don't think that has any impact, but in fact, I think it's the only thing that has moved this issue forward. So it doesn't take that many people. You know, if we get a couple of dozen, a couple of hundred people, it's seen as an issue then. And if you want to get involved with the association, join up. We certainly can use your help.
Speaking with Mark Boyce at the University of Alberta, you know, I had the understandable feeling. Is the greater sage-grouse too far gone now? Is this a fight even worth getting involved in? And he reminded me that things could be worse.
We've got lots of them in North America where species have been on the brink of extinction. We've brought them back. We were down to 14 whooping cranes in the world. And we went from 14 to now, you know, the world global population, something like 550 or something like that. So we can do it.
Thanks to Mark Boyce, David Heidloff, and Cliff Wallace for their help on that story. For more information, visit our website and you can find a link to the Athabasca Wilderness Association's website. That's at terrainforma.ca. If that story piqued your interest, follow us on Twitter, at Terra Informa, and join the conversation. Come on, let's give them something to squawk about.
The sage-grouse isn't the only thing ruffling feathers in Alberta right now. Have you ever felt like you've been left out of the loop by those in the know?
This is a situation many Albertans have found themselves in weeks following the Obed Mountain mine release, the biggest coal sludge spill in Canadian history. Trevor Chow Fraser and Morgana Folkman attended the second public forum about the mine release on February 27th. The event was organized by the Alberta Ministry of Environment, Sustainable Resource Development, and the University of Alberta's Water Initiative. They shared their findings of the independent scientific review of Sherritt International's Obed mine release remediation plans. Here's what they learned.
On October 31, 2013, at the Sherritt International Obed coal mine up in northern Alberta, a berm around a tailings pond burst.
What's a tailings pond? Well, it's where a mine keeps all of the wastewater left over after extracting coal ore out of the rock.
So what this means is that almost 700 million liters of water and 90,000 tons of sediment drained out of that tailings pond. It's the largest recorded coal slurry spill in Canadian history, the second biggest in North America.
The water alone is enough to fill 240 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
A very vivid image for me was the description of the creek that the Obed spill first poured into. Originally, 1 meter from bank to bank, the force of the water from this spill ripped the trees out along the edges, expanding the width of this stream to 20 meters.
The spill ended up in the Athabasca River, about 5 kilometers away. At this point, the plume is believed to have extended to Lake Athabasca, over 300 kilometers downstream. With a disaster of this scope, you're probably wondering, well, why did it happen? And more importantly, what possible health effects will this have downstream? And what are the environmental impacts that have already taken place?
The Alberta government recently gave everyone the opportunity to try and find some answers to these questions. In late February, they hosted a forum that brought together a number of experts and key stakeholders.
First Nations chiefs were there, river keepers and water keepers, spokespeople from the coal company and from government, and 4 scientists from the University of Alberta Water Initiative.
In November 2013, Alberta Environment and Sustainable Resource Development engaged the University of Alberta Water Initiative to provide an independent third-party scientific review of Sherritt's response plans. This is to ensure that the plans are in keeping with the Alberta government's environmental protection order.
So what was the environmental impact of the spill? It stretched from the origin of the spill near Hinton all the way down to Lake Athabasca, quite a long distance. Unfortunately, we can't know the long-term effects until more data is collected, which is especially difficult given the expanse of the spill, as well as the fact that all of these waterways are currently frozen. I spoke to Tim Jardine, assistant professor at the School of Environment and Sustainability at the University of Saskatchewan. He's a member of the Water Initiative, and after the forum, he spoke to me in more detail about the impact the spill will have on the area and especially on the fish.
Typically, fish, anything that's capable of moving often will move. So if there's sediment that's suspended in the water, that's being carried by the water, the fish will sense that. They'll smell it, they'll see it, they'll taste it, and they'll move. Of course, if the speed of the water is so high, the fish may lose their ability to swim against that current and may be washed downstream. And, in the creek immediately downstream from the release site, those trees along the banks provide very important cover for fish. They cool down the water. They filter nutrients and pollutants that are coming off the land. So those trees that grow along the stream banks are very important. And right now those trees are gone.
Are you concerned about any like toxic substances in the water that might affect, how would that affect the fish?
Yeah, so there are two concerns. One is what's called acute toxicity, so that's the immediate toxicity associated with that. From what I've read of the documentation, it suggests that the company did some testing on fish, and they didn't find any toxic effects. The bigger concern is what would be considered chronic effects, so long-term effects, particularly for those chemicals that will accumulate, that will increase in the animal's tissues over time. And we know the general principle in toxicology is the dose makes the poison. And so if an animal is accumulating those toxins over time, they may not be immediately affected, but eventually the concentrations will reach some point where they do become toxic.
So just as we don't yet know the impact on wildlife, it'll take time to assess the risks faced by First Nations and others living downstream.
We did collect sediment, as I showed you before, from those locations, and those are being analyzed for quite a comprehensive suite of parameters, including some not so common parameters like various isotopes that will help us to fingerprint this material and track its location along the bed of the Athabasca River, both right now and in the future. So we should be able to tell what the long-term fate of this material was and how it's going to behave in the environment.
It's important to note that while the coal slurry will not have any immediate toxic effects, chronic effects may be a problem. This is because of the fact that the river's frozen and the amount of time it takes to determine the fingerprint of the slurry, and the fact that it isn't even known how far the plume may have actually traveled. Here's what we do know so far. Data provided by Sherritt's own scientists shows excessive silver, arsenic, and lead in the water, most dramatically in the days right after the spill. Within the plume, there was 760 times as much lead as can be found in waters further south.
So in terms of health impacts and in terms of environmental impacts, there's a lot of uncertainty. And as we wait for the scientists to come back with harder facts, People are getting restless. Managing relations with those potentially affected is really crucial for the government and for Sherrod at this point. But so far, there seems to be a lack of trust between downstream communities on the one hand and Alberta government and Sherrod International on the other. Downstream communities complained that they weren't notified of the spill directly by the company. And they complained that information about health risks kept changing in the weeks after the spill, so they didn't know what to be concerned about.
Many of the downstream communities are First Nations, and they are some of the most vocal stakeholders in the forum. Because I wasn't able to catch up with First Nations leadership at the forum, I spoke with Dr. Makary Stewart Harawira. She moderated the first public forum in December, and I wanted to get a sense from her of what the actual input from Aboriginal groups has been. It was strongly emphasized during the forum by both Sherrod and the Alberta government.
My name is Makary Stewart Harawira, and I'm from Aotearoa, New Zealand, and I'm a member of the Waitaha tribe. Yeah, it's about consultation, but you know, what they also were talking about was monitoring, being involved in remediation, being able to use their own local specific, historically long-term knowledge to say these are some things that need to be looked at, these are some ways that we need to be addressing these issues, rather than a one-way flow of information, which is, okay, this is what we're doing, we're letting you know this is okay, this is not okay. So what they're experiencing is this kind of barrage of, as somebody said, emails going their way that are purporting to provide them with information, but it is not about giving them real contribution and real participation. That's my concern. There's a history of problematic relationships between First Nations and government. So, of course, there's a great mistrust, and there's a great mistrust for science. Not for science per se, but for the way in which scientists privilege their own form of knowledge, of course, over Indigenous knowledge.
So coming out of the forum, it seems the big question is, how can you build trust among the affected groups when the science says that we need to take our time to plan things carefully? No charges have yet been laid in the disaster. There hasn't even been an explanation of why the berm broke to begin with. To top it off, Sherrod doesn't even own the mine anymore. Sherrod sold Obed a few months after the spill, selling it to Colorado-based Westmoreland, but it is still responsible for funding continued cleanup.
Certainly we're not proud of the event that happened that evening, and we're sorry that this release took place from our site, but we're committed to making it right. A huge part of making it right is recognizing and having a deep respect for Aboriginal people's rights. We've been committed to and are continuing to build upon our commitment to meaningful dialogue with Aboriginal communities and the communities around the areas of the mine and the Athabasca River. We will continue diligently to execute authorized activities under the Environmental Protection Order and to meet any outstanding requirements. We will be working with regulatory authorities, scientific and engineering experts, to understand the long-term impacts of the release.
There was a definite attempt by Sherrod and the initiative and the Alberta government to appear transparent and like they were involving First Nations groups. However, Sherrod admitted that they were currently only talking with 4 of 50 groups that they had initially contacted in the weeks after the spill. In my mind, the most interesting part of this whole trust-building exercise is that Alberta Environment felt it had to bring in outside experts to review their work. This says to me that they realize how little the public trusts government and industry scientists to be impartial judges.
Our opinion was that we engaged Water Initiative to provide us with the best science forward. And so what we did is we simply passed on their recommendations to Sherrod. We didn't edit them. We didn't change them in any way. We simply passed all those recommendations on with the sort of thought that being that it's up to Sherrod, if they don't want to implement some of those recommendations, that they have to provide us with scientific reason as to why they don't think those are necessary.
The university water experts appear to be experienced and dedicated to their work.
Group of us were completely independent. We're not consultants. We are scientists with a significant and sincere concern for the environment. But what we really want to do is make sure that the science is done properly so that we can do a proper assessment. We want to make sure that the science is appropriate for the people and for the rehabilitation of the land and the water for everybody.
Reporting for Terra Informa,
I'm Morgana Folkman.
And I'm Trevor Chow Fraser.
Was Morgana Folkman and Trevor Chow Fraser discussing the 2013 Obed Mine Release Public Forum at the University of Alberta in Edmonton last month. Thanks to all those who participated and allowed us to share their views. More about the release is available on our website, terrainforma.ca. And now, for environmental events happening in your community, here's what's happening.
On March 15th and 16th, there will be an introductory course to permaculture at the Heritage Harvest Farm in Jasper, Ontario. Learn how to design sustainable environments that you can apply to gardens, landscapes, business models, and even your personal life. Cost is about $130 a person, and space is limited, so if you're interested, sign up ASAP at heritageharvestfarms.ca.
Also on the 15th and 16th, but in London, Ontario, learn to follow your bliss and heal the world through spiritual ecology. This weekend is all about finding out how you can live your passions from an ecocentric perspective that uses the earth as a guide. Lorena Busque-Casera, the founder of Shamanu, will be facilitating. If this event speaks to your soul, visit thelivingcenter.com for more information about pricing and registration.
On Sunday, March 16th, there'll be a CD Sunday at the Alberta Ave Community Hall in Edmonton, Alberta. You can swap fruit, vegetable, and flower seeds, enjoy presentations from experienced growers on gardening, and learn about like-minded local organizations. There's even room for kids, with homemade snacks, and admission is free, so don't hesitate to stop on by.
And that's what's happening. Links to all these events are available on our website. Once again, that's terrainforma.ca. And that's a wrap for this week's show. We hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks to this week's contributors, Chris Cheng and Phillips, Danielle Dolgoy, Morgana Folkman, and Trevor Chow Fraser.
Tasmia Nishath for updating our website, and to you, Hamdi, for coordinating.
Why, thank you. Terra Informa is produced out of CGSR in Edmonton, Alberta. If you'd like to share your thoughts on one of our stories, or even share one of your own, drop a line to terra@cgsr.com. Special shout out to Tanner James from Calgary, that's at Alberta Nights on Twitter, for finding what he was looking for. We've been your hosts, Hamdi Asawi
and Natalie Raweth. Join us next week for more environmental news from coast to coast to coast.
Ciao for now.
Bye.
Do it again?
I'm okay with that.
Let's give him something to squawk about.
You should do both. Let's see which one's better.
Let's do a
duet? Okay.
Let's give him something to squawk about.
Brilliant.
One of those cuts will make it.
Yeah.